Hello, I'm Matt Mayton, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. This week, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And we've got a very varied new slate of movies to review this week, including star-powered comedy thriller Wolfs with George Clooney and Brad Pitt, Saoirse Ronan's alcohol addiction recovery drama The Outrun, Francis Ford Coppola's self-financed passion project Megalopolis, Halle Berry horror Never Let Go, the latest attempt at rebooting Hellboy for the big screen, and high-concept coming-of-age dramedy My Old Ass. But before we get into those new releases, have you been watching anything else this week, Jordan?
Nothing that the rest of the planet haven't been watching as well in The Rings of Power season two
Okay.
and Agatha All Along, which I am one episode behind on both, but I can't speak to the very latest news from both of those shows. But in both cases, actually, I feel quite similar about them because I'm sort of enjoying them both without absolutely loving either of them. The same could be said of The Rings of Power season one, which I sort of enjoyed as it was going along, but just didn't give me the same sort of wow factor that the films gave me. I'm sort of seeing nothing in season two at the moment which has improved on it in any significant way, although I am reliably informed through the journalist slash Ents reporter grapevine that the next couple of episodes are spectacular, so I'm very much looking forward to those. And the same for Agatha All Along, in the sense that I sort of enjoyed those first two episodes enough, which are the only two I've seen so far. I actually particularly enjoyed the opening stretch of that first episode, the premiere, where it's the Mayor of Easttown spoof. I was really into that, to the point that I would have quite enjoyed watching a true crime series with Catherine Hahn. But episode two kind of lost me a tiny bit. But I'm interested enough to keep going and to see where it's heading. What about you, Matt?
I shamefully have, I've literally watched virtually nothing else this week besides what we're the things we're discussing.
It's a busy week. There was a lot to watch.
There's lots to watch, and we've just been, you know, finishing a mag as well. So that's been very full on this time, as I mean, it always is, but particularly full on this time. I suppose what I have watched is we occasionally do a thing in the office called Trailer Club, which we brought back to life this week and watched the Gladiator 2 trailer, which gave away a sort of something big and surprising, almost twist like. I won't mention that here just in case anyone's been sort of actively trying to avoid that, but I mean, you will have a fairly hard job avoiding that, I'd say. But I mean, it looks pretty cool, looks pretty damn epic, so excited about that one.
Well, we also double billed it with Thunderbolts, dropped a new trailer, well, dropped the first trailer this week.
Yes, and so that kind of came completely out of nowhere. Like, we were expecting the Gladiator trailer, but then suddenly Thunderbolts, the new Marvel, came out of nowhere, and that looked pretty good as well, I thought. I mean, it was kind of exciting just because it came so out of the blue, but some sort of cool characters to have back, particularly Florence Pugh's Yelena and David Harbour's Red Guardian. I'm sort of excited to see those again, and Bucky Barnes, of course. Can't say I was completely sold on the trailer, you know, in the sense that couldn't tell exactly what was going on. And so some of the characters, you know, I was less fussed about seeing the return of than others, I'll say. You know, intriguing. Let's see what it's got. It did have a nice, slightly different tone. I hope it's one of those slightly sort of lower stakes ones. It's a bit more fun, a bit more sort of light on its feet. But what did you make of that trailer?
Yeah, I felt very similarly, to be honest. I found it a very odd just pitch from the inception, really. Just having sort of C to D list villain characters team up just felt like an odd choice. But Yelena is just a great character to sort of lead the group. And often it is just, you know, as proven by Guardians of the Galaxy back in the day, it often is just like the underdog film that you're just expecting the least from that ends up being one of the biggest surprises. So maybe this will turn out to be this phase as Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, where everyone had sort of written it off going in, but turns out to be a real treat. So yeah, I'm not writing it off personally just yet. I'm yet to see anything that has completely convinced me that it'll be great, but yeah, remaining optimistic.
So on to full films now, rather than just trailers. And starting off this week's new releases, it's an old school star-powered vehicle for the streaming era.
I was told that if I ever needed help, to call you.
You're a man who can fix things.
I didn't know people like you really existed.
They don't. There's nobody can do what I do.
Who are you?
I'm here to take care of your problem. Who called you?
We clearly have a situation here. The only course of action is for you to work together to clean up this mess.
No.
It's not how I work.
This is not how I work.
Oh.
It's a different thing now.
It's going to be a long night.
This is Wolfs, which is the latest film from director John Watts, currently best known for making the Tom Holland Spider-Man trilogy. He also made a thriller called Cop Car before that, going back more into that kind of territory, I guess. And it's famously returned to the kind of star-powered movie, you know, where it's really, really being sold on chemistry of these two guys, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and also plays into their real-life friendship and the bants and all that kind of thing. In terms of the plot, the basic gist is these two guys who are, you know, pretty much unnamed in the film, both fixers, the people you call upon to turn up to sort of help clean up a sticky situation. Right at the start of the film, Amy Ryan's Margaret is sort of in a hotel room, and it starts off in quite almost like a thriller-like fashion, really, without much comedy at all. And she's in a hotel room. There's a young guy we can see lying on the floor, you know, head smashed in, glass everywhere. And she kind of desperately calls this mysterious number she's been given for, you know, situations like this, should she ever find herself in them. And before long, George Clooney's character turns up and, you know, he's kind of there to do his thing, tidy up the mess. And he's, you know, as the title suggests, he's a kind of lone wolf. And he's, you know, he's got this very, very particular set of skills. And, you know, he knows exactly what's doing in this kind of situation. But, you know, mere moments after he's arrived, Brad Pitt's character turns up. And there's been a bit of crossed wires almost in this situation that kind of gets explained away a little bit as we go on. But he's been called upon by someone else to come and also tidy up this situation. And someone related to the hotel in which it's happened in. So he turns up with his particular set of skills to do it. And so then right from the off, there's this kind of rivalry and banter between the two guys who are now basically forced to work together to tidy up this situation, despite the fact that they're both, as you know, the title says again, they're both lone wolves and they're used to just doing their own thing. They've got their own little tricks for doing everything. They've got their own secrets. So they're very much not keen on, you know, teaming up with anyone else, but here they find themselves. And that's kind of how the film starts. And as you can guess, there's a bit of twistiness and further revelations from there, but that's where it starts. Jordan, did you actually enjoy this film?
Yes, to an extent, although more broadly, I would say I was fairly disappointed by this, just because I was very excited to see Brad Pitt and George Clooney back on the screen for the first time in over a decade, I think, like properly, in terms of them bouncing off each other, you know, obviously in the Ocean's films, although they've been in other things together, but not much. The thing that really let me down was just the plotting of it. It just felt like it was aiming for that convoluted crime narrative thing that Tarantino does so well. Obviously, the name Wolfs itself is clearly an homage to Winston Wolfe, Harvey Keitel's character in Pulp Fiction. He is the cleaner. Brad Pitt and Joyce Clooney's characters in this film are cleaners. I think it's very much wearing that influence on its sleeve, but John Watts just isn't as adept a writer as Tarantino is. He just can't do that crime narrative thing half as elegantly or as thrillingly as Tarantino can. I was also just really hung up on how weirdly lifeless the film felt as well. Clooney and Pitt are just the burning sun at the center of it all, but everything around them just felt so artificial and unreal to me. Like, they're in this city, it's in the middle of the night, fair enough, but there's just no one on the streets, which I just found very strange. And then they go to a sort of party at one point, and then there's dozens of people at this party. So why aren't people just out walking the streets? Why aren't they bumping into people more often? There's this big foot chase, which you'll have probably glimpsed in the trailer if you've watched that, where they're chasing Kid, played by Austin Abrams, who's running around the streets in his tidy whitey underpants, which is quite a fun sequence. But they just don't see anyone during this whole chase. And I just couldn't get past the fact that it just felt so soundstagey. It felt so much like a movie fakery. I did enjoy seeing Clooney and Pitt together on screen again. They do, you know, they're such charismatic chaps that they can make almost anything sing, and they do get the occasional laugh out of okay dialogue. But overall, I just felt, Yeah, this very much didn't live up to the sum of its parts.
Yeah, I felt very similarly, really. And I've spoken to some people about it, 'cause it got kind of mixed reactions when it premiered at Venice. It was one of those things I went into it with modest expectations, to be honest. And so to begin with, I was kind of like, yeah, actually, this is all right. I'm enjoying it, you know, like he says, enjoying having those two together. The individual and combined charisma is undeniable. But yeah, then I found it really lost me as it went on, because it was a really strange combination, I felt, of too slow, but then also too convoluted somehow at the same time. It was moving a bit too slowly for my liking for this kind of film. But I still struggled to follow what was going on at times. And I don't know if that was just me being thick, but without going into spoilers, there were just various things I didn't understand. And we get to a point at the end where, you know, some people explain some stuff that's been going on, and I couldn't tell, is this like a joke that I'm just not supposed to understand this, and they're just saying something that I would have never gleaned from the film, or have I somehow just missed this, or has the storytelling been that sort of clumsy that I just don't really know what's going on? That was sort of puzzling for me there. And then it was a strange thing also as well, because it's kind of, in some ways it's too convoluted, but in other ways I expected more satisfying twists to come up. I expected there to be more satisfying revelations tied to the sort of central characters and the central cleanup job that they're on, which just never really came for me. And just various things about it just didn't make sense. That, you know, I don't want to go into sort of too many spoilers at this point, but that troubled me and left me with a sort of left it with a bad taste in my mouth, in the sense that, you know, I was enjoying it well enough to begin with, but kind of came away thinking, what was that, you know? And there's this, again, without going to spoilers, but there's a couple of sort of hinted at sort of shootouts towards the end that just don't really materialize. And I found that quite anticlimactic. Yeah, just strange appearances from character actors that you think are going to lead to something a bit more, and then they just don't. So I found that really bizarre. It's like, if for better and worse, it's exceptionally slick in that it looks nice, it's filmed with some dynamism. There's a nice kind of like little pulsy electronic score by Theodore Shapiro. And like you mentioned, that chase where Austin Abrams is running around in his tighty-whities and they're kind of chasing after him in a combination of on foot and in car. There's a nice kind of dynamism to the way that shot, you know, it moves kind of nicely with a nice sense of speed and everything. Strangely as well, this was a film that, you know, I believe was supposed to be getting a cinema release in the UK, but then has ended up going straight to Apple TV Plus. And it definitely, for me, falls into that category that if you're a subscriber, so you can watch it for quote unquote free at home, then it's perfectly fine. It's acceptable. You got that star power. It's slick, you know, some funny moments. It's fine. But I think if you'd made the effort to go out for a night at the cinema with this, I'd have come away very disappointed, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like it's a home on the streaming service, to be frank. At the same time that they announced that move away from cinemas to streaming, they also announced the sequel was in development, which, do we really need a sequel to this? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I will say one thing I did forget to mention, which I did really like, was Austin Abrams, because he's essentially the third hander in this film. He's very much a presence throughout the whole thing, and he does really hold his own against Clooney and Pitt, which is extremely commendable. And he has one sort of, I guess you could call it a monologue or a soliloquy in the middle of the film, where he sort of details what led up to his discovery in this comatose state at the start of the film. And it is just really gripping and entertaining. And I thought, wow, that's a real sort of star-making turn. I mean, Austin Abrams has been around for a little while. I thought he was exceptional in a film called Brad's Status, which Mike White made back in 2017. And he's done plenty of things since then. Euphoria, perhaps most notably. But yeah, this felt like a real sort of arrival kind of performance to me, where I could see him going on and being cast in much bigger things in the future.
Yeah, I was slightly less sold on him, but I won't go into it too much.
Oh, after my impassioned
I mean, I
declaration
must
of.
say, no, but why I'm not going to go on too much is, again, I know I've spoken to someone else who's seen it and they feel the same as you. So I think maybe I was just in a miserable mood by the point he's kind of properly in the film, that maybe I didn't give him a fair shot. Without going into spoilers, I want to just know if you feel the same way about me as this. There's a sort of like over the credits footage we see. It's basically CCTV footage from like an earlier time point in the film. And what I found really strange about that is, to me, it just didn't add anything. Whereas I expected, I was like, oh, okay, right, we're going to see something funny or, you know, thrilling here that changes how we've viewed the event so far. But it just didn't at all. And again, it just added to the slightly half-baked feeling I had with the whole film. Like, it was just a bit sort of almost like I hadn't had the kind of thought that this kind of plotting needs. That's how I felt anyway. And
I really think that John Watts thinks that he's made something much smarter and cooler than it actually is, because I was just left singularly unimpressed by its smarts and its cools. None of that kind of impressed me in any way. I mainly just came away thinking, yeah, I like George Clooney, I like Brad Pitt, and I like Austin Abrams, and that was about it.
But if you fancy giving that a go, that is Wolfs, which is streaming on Apple TV Plus now. Next, we're changing tone and escaping to the Orkney Islands with this.
Sometimes you can feel a vibration in Orkney, a low rumble. It takes over the whole island and every part of your body. There is only so much height any wave can sustain before it comes crashing down. I'm sorry.
I can't hear you say that again. I wish you were a completely different person.
The urge to drink can come out of nowhere. You think you're doing well. Suddenly you want nothing more than a drink.
So this is The Outrun, which is based on the memoir of the same name by Amy Liptrot. In short, it's basically the story of a woman recovering from alcohol addiction, and she returns to sort of her home on the Orkney Islands as a big part of this, and sort of escapes from it, or escapes from the city there, and goes to this real kind of isolated place. The story jumps back and forth in time, so we see her at various different stages of the recovery and in the addiction. And Rona, the lead character, is played by Saoirse Ronan. She's in a relationship with Papa Essidu's Danin. And then there's also, we see a relationship with her parents and how she kind of starts, working on this island. Yeah. And so then it just follows that, really. It's a kind of non-linear look at this recovery from addiction, really. But Jordan, how did you find it? I know you obviously interviewed Saoirse Ronan for the magazine for this.
I really like this, primarily for Saoirse Ronan, who I think is just exceptional in this film. And I will be entirely unsurprised if she gets another Best Actress nomination for a performance in this. It's a very sort of raw and primal performance. The interesting thing about it is, because of the time hopping structure, you both get to see Rona at her lowest and you get to see her in recovery, which I think is actually a really nice way to handle a film like this, where, the standard alcoholic on film narrative is you just see someone crash and burn and then maybe claw their way back towards the end. With this, you have a bit of everything running through, and the two kind of parallel trajectories play off each other quite nicely in the way it's been edited. So I really like that. I also very much enjoyed the sort of quite unique setting of it, which is the Isle of Orkney, and reconnecting with nature and kind of finding yourself just amid the elements is just a big part of the narrative of the film. It just lends it a really cinematic side as well, where you just get to experience these amazing vistas, these incredible kind of coastal views. At one point, she stays in this, it's like a glorified shed, basically, where the winds are just so intense that it's blowing a gale literally inside through the crack in a window, and you can just really feel what it must be like to live in one of those places, just in these remote locations in the middle of nowhere, basically. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting elements that feed into it, and it's all just anchored by this incredible Saoirse Ronan performance. And I just found her just an extremely convincing alcoholic. Like, she doesn't do the thing where she's slurring her speech and closing one eye and hiccuping and all those sort of cliches thing. She just does feel very convincingly like a self-destructive alcoholic in those scenes, and it's actually quite painful and difficult to watch some of the things that she does to herself, these self-inflicted pains. Seeing her in rehabilitation is also just extremely like affirming and rewarding to see this character go through the worst that life can sort of throw at you and then claw her way back out. So yeah, I thought there was a lot to commend in this. Just very humanistic supporting characters as well. You have Stephen Delane and Saskia Rees as her parents. Her dad is he has dementia, or he's suffering from some kind of degenerative illness, and her mother's a sort of born again Christian, so she has her own unique perspective on what her daughter is going through, and it's part of the reason why Rona feels pushed away by her parents, because she isn't accepted by her mother and she finds it difficult to be around her father on his off days. There's a lot of like interesting details that I guess comes from the fact that this is a memoir, that this is ripped from real life. Feels like those are the kind of interesting little details that you wouldn't necessarily get if this was a purely fictional film. But yeah, the main thing to recommend about this is Saoirse Ronan's performance, which just is another just sort of all-timer from her, really.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I pretty much agree with everything you've said, and especially with Saoirse. And to me, she's, yeah, like one of the best of her generation. And this kind of just affirms that, again, it is the reason to go and see the film, really. I also found that, like, this is one of those films that has sort of these little like animated interludes as well, which if I wasn't enjoying the film could have really annoyed me, but I actually quite enjoyed those here. And if anything, if I kind of had to have a sort of a small quibble, it was that I felt like maybe the time did jump around a bit too much, and you've got the character's hair color changing to give you a bit of a kind of grounding in terms of where you are, but I thought it perhaps just leapt a bit too much, and there was like a bit too much back and forth to different points that maybe that could have been a little bit more restrained, maybe. But yeah, a fairly minor quibble overall, really. As you mentioned, I just really liked being immersed in that world that they go to, and it's almost like a strange, especially like seeing a film like this in a cinema, which again, maybe you might not think of a very character-based, very personal sort of story, but seeing it in the cinema, one, the visuals, you know, of the landscapes, but just the immersion in that sort of sound with like the howling winds that you get there. It almost felt like a sort of ASMR like type experience in a cinema. So for that strange...
Body X.
Yeah. So for that reason, it was an unexpectedly sort of cinematic experience for me as well, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, all credit to Nora Fingscheid, the director who previously helmed perhaps System Crashed Her, most notably, but also directed The Unforgiven, the Sandra Bullock film. She just does a really good job with the material, like really making it cinematic and filmic and making it worthy of the big screen. It's a strange thing to contrast this with Wolves, which obviously has all the ingredients, should make it like a big screen experience, but very much feels small screen. And this, on paper, probably does feel more like a streaming release, but very much does warrant its place in a cinema. So yeah, I'd very much recommend you go and see this in a cinema. If you can.
So that was The Outrun, which is in cinemas now. And next, one of the great auteurs returns with an extremely ambitious, self-financed passion project.
My plan is a city that people can dream about.
Megalopolis.
What about those standing in your way?
Power the people!
You like it the way it is.
People don't need dreams.
People need help now.
Don't let the now destroy the forever.
We're in need of a great debate about the future.
Enjoy the show.
1, 2, 3. Yippee-yay.
So this is Megalopolis. I haven't actually seen this one this week. So Jordan, could you set this one up for us for anyone who hasn't heard about Francis Ford Coppola's latest big screen endeavor?
Yep, I'm unbelievably excited to tell you about this one, Matt, because it's even more unhinged than you might be expecting. So yeah, this is Francis Ford Coppola's decades in the making passion project, self-financed to the tune of some $120 million after he sold a portion of his very successful winery in California to fund it, which is just part of the amazing origin story of this film. So it's set in a sort of decaying future city called New Rome. The central character that we follow is an architect called Cesar Catalina, one of many absolutely amazing names in this film, played by Adam Driver. He's the chairman of the design authority, and he is the person who's in charge of sort of redesigning the city's architecture and buildings. But he also, for inexplicable reasons, has the ability to stop time, which you may know if you've seen the film's trailer, but is actually a much less significant part of the film than you would imagine. Catalina is, he's sort of the celebrity of New Rome. He's almost like the Tony Stark of the city in a way. He's this genius playboy philanthropist. Everyone loves him, including WoW Platinum, played by Aubrey Plaza, who is a TV presenter who presents a show about money and wealthy people, but also has the hots for Catalina. Catalina is in a sort of adversarial position to the mayor, Franklin Cicero, played by Giancarlo Esposito. He's very much on the side of practicality and giving the people what they need within the city, running the city to a budget. Whereas Catalina, he's discovered this new material called Megalon, and he has this dream to rebuild New Rome as Megalopolis, which is this purely futuristic vision that he has of what the city could be. Cicero and Catalina's antagonistic relationship is complicated by the fact that Julia Cicero, who is the mayor's daughter, obviously finds herself falling for Catalina and starts working for him and goes into the relationship with him. Also, around all this, you just have a lot of family politics going on because you also have John Voight in there as Crassus, who is the wealthiest man in the world, who is also Catalina's uncle. You have Shia LaBeouf in there as Clodio, who is Crassus's son, and the cousin of Catalina. And then you've got a lot of very famous people around the fringes who do exceptionally little within the film, but our presence is there, including Lawrence Fishburne, Talia Shire, Coppola regular, of course, Jason Schwartzman, Chloe Fineman from Saturday Night Live, James Remar, Balthazar Getty from, I don't think I'd seen him in anything since Lost Highway. I don't know what he's been up to. And Dustin Hoffman, who I haven't seen in a film for about, I don't know, about 10 years, it feels like at this point. So you've got absolutely tons and tons of people in here. A totally bonkers to set up for the film where you're just thrown in truly at the deep end. You have just insane characters thrown at you constantly. It's really taken its inspiration from the Roman Empire and Shakespeare. Very early on, there's a sort of press conference where Catalina and Cicero, the mayor, both present their competing visions for the future of the city. And inexplicably, Catalina just starts quoting Shakespeare, like just going off on one, like Shakespeare monologues. And I just didn't really see the reasoning. I just found myself completely bewildered by the whole thing, to be honest. It's been sold as this completely new vision for cinema by, proved genius Francis Ford Coppola, who has done this previously. Everyone wrote off Apocalypse Now when it was being made during its hellish production, where it took years to get to the screen. And Megalopolis has had a similarly naysaying narrative around it, where the whole story around its creation has been that this is just going to be some grand folly. But I'd be very surprised, extremely surprised, if this ever has an Apocalypse Now style kind of turnaround, because I just found this one of the more baffling films I've seen in a long time. I really don't understand almost what it was about on a basic level, let alone like found anything profound or meaningful in it. It's very bizarre that so many people decided to hitch their wagons to it when most of these characters, they have nothing to do in it, basically. I imagine most just wanted to be part of it because it was the opportunity to work on what will probably end up being one of, if not Francis Ford Coppola's last film. And you can't blame people for wanting to be in a Francis Ford Coppola film, but whatever Francis Ford Coppola had in his head just hasn't translated onto screen in the way that it needs to be a satisfying 140-minute theatrical experience. It's just very bizarre from start to finish, and I took very little from it.
I mean, it sounds obviously utterly bonkers, but is it kind of bonkers in a funny way, or is it just end up being bonkers in a sort of boring way?
It's a good question. There is a lot of humor in it, but I'm not entirely sure if it was intentional or not a lot of the time. I would imagine that a lot of it was quite unintentional, and you do just find yourself chuckling away at things that I think are meant to be taken seriously at points. The whole stopping time element is just another just completely baffling, confusing element of the film, because it's very much set up early on that this is going to be a significant thing in the film. And it's part of the reason why Catalina and Julia come together in the first place, in that she isn't frozen when Catalina freezes time, which is part of why she discovers that he can do this. But then it just doesn't really come back at all in the film, which I found very bizarre. It almost feels like a film that's just been hacked to bits and has had big chunks of it cut out, but the fact that Francis Ford Coppola financed this himself just makes me think this just must, he must have had final cut on this. So this must just be the full extent of what he wanted to put on the screen. There's also quite famously a sort of live action element with this film, a live acting element. When the film premiered at Cannes in May, there is a moment in the film where a real person stepped up in front of the screen with a microphone, asks a question, and Adam Driver's character, Catalina, responds as though he is answering a question from this live performer. But when I saw it, that wasn't the case, unfortunately. They simply had a question asked off screen, and that was it. As far as I'm aware, you're not even going to get that slightly unique live performance element if you go and see this in the cinema. I mean, it would have been a big ask to do that in cinemas across the country, so I can see why they've changed it. But even these elements where you feel like he's like playing with the form of what cinema can be, like even those have been stripped out, and just what is left just slightly baffling, and just makes me wonder why he would want to spend such an eye-watering amount of money on something which is seemingly destined just to end up on the scrap heap of film history, you know.
Does it even look nice? Does that money look like you can kind of see it on screen?
I had a very mixed feeling about how it looks, because yes, it does look expensive sometimes, but then there are just very ropey visual effects in it as well. Like there's some very poor like green screen and compositing work in it, which really just undercuts the fact that they have spent this much money on it. There's no denying it looks very lavish. There are some like huge sets that have been built. Just when you have like a simple dialogue exchange between characters, sometimes it just happens to take place in the middle of a giant parade in the middle of the city, and you're just thinking, could this have not just happened in some room and you could have saved yourself $5 million? Did you really need to spend all this money? And obviously the cast that he's pulled together, like you would imagine that must have accounted for a decent chunk of change. Like he hasn't hired cheap people here. Just a very, very odd one, and just a real shame, because you know Francis Ford Coppola is one of the greats of cinema history. You know, like he reinvented what movies were in the 70s alongside, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg and George Lucas and Brian De Palma. Like he was just at the vanguard of what movie making was, and this just feels not like something from a lost era, but it just feels like he's completely out of step with what people want from movies today. And I don't think that this film's going to convince anyone that this is the future of cinema either.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm convinced to go and see this.
I will say there are dissenting opinions to my own out there. There are people that have given this film a positive review. So if you are sort of intrigued by the potential of it, I would recommend giving it a go. Like it might be something that clicks with you more than it clicked with me. But yeah, it very much didn't work for me. And yeah, I can't see Francis clawing back that $120 million anytime soon.
Well, if you want to contribute to the box office of this film, that is Megalopolis, and that is in cinemas now. And next up, hold on tight for this new horror.
Y'all ready?
Never let go.
Never let go.
Never let go.
Never let go.
Life's been hard on you, boy, since the world ended.
But remember,
one touch without a rope on is all it takes.
Remind the house what we deserve is protection.
O blessed house of ancient wood.
Shelter to the pure and good.
We'll keep you bright and never wrong. Heaven is here within our home.
Did it touch you?
So this is Never Let Go. Jordan, do you want to set this one up for us?
So this is the new horror film from French director Alexandre Aja, who most recently directed a Netflix film called Oxygen, but you possibly know best as the director of Alligator on the Loose movie Crawl and The Hills Have Eyes remake. It stars Halle Berry as Mama. She has two young sons, Samuel, played by Anthony B. Jenkins, and Nolan, played by Percy Daggs IV. They live in a cabin in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And we learn very early on that around this cabin is a force known only as the Evil, which is preventing Mama, Samuel and Nolan from leaving the house. The only way that they can step foot off the front porch is to tie a rope around their waist, which is attached to the wooden foundations of the house. And this allows them to go out into the woods and to go foraging, go hunting, just purely to stay alive. And that really is just the very basic, simple setup of the film. And the entire film that unspools from that point is a sort of more of a sort of psychological paranoid horror thriller than a sort of extreme gnarly gore fest, which you might expect from Aja, in the sense that we're never entirely sure whether the evil is real or not. It's very much playing on the idea that it could all just be in the characters' heads. Like, it doesn't ever really give you rock solid proof until it needs to. And the whole time, you're left wondering, is it real? Is it not real? Is the fact that they're in the middle of nowhere, are we just going to be pulling a village here and we're going to find out that on the other side of this tree line, there is civilization? You know, Mama's claiming that the evil wiped out society. Is that true? The kids are obviously too young to know a world other than the one that they've been raised in with their mama. We do see the evil apparitions, which always come through in forms which torment the characters. Mama's own mother, for example, is one of the key representations of the evil, and they kind of speak to and just try to undermine the characters to make them step out into the woods without the life raft of the rope around them. And then eventually, of course, the sons start to realize that maybe everything they've been told by Mama isn't real. Maybe they need to go and test the boundaries themselves. There are events that force their hand. So yeah, it's fair. And then it all just sort of builds to a head. That's sort of the basic premise of the film. What did you think, Matt?
So that's the setup. Yeah, I was going to say, did you actually like it? Because I saw this a little while ago and I must admit, I just didn't really like it that much. To go on the positives, a couple of bits really made me jump early on, even though, like you say, it's not the kind of goriest scare fest. There were a couple of like big jumps early on, which got me good.
I would say it's fairly cheap stuff though. Loud noise jump scare stuff. It's not like, you know, it's not the head popping out from under the boat in Jaws, you know.
It was effectively done, yeah, if you know, like playing to the rules. And the other positive is I thought the young actors in it playing the kids, I thought they were very good actually. But then beyond that, I actually struggled to get into this one. I found the sort of mythology a bit silly. I didn't really like the design of the scary characters. I found that again verged on the silly for me a bit, with their kind of, you know, horrible tongues sticking out and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't know, I just didn't really get that into this sort of ambiguous premise either. But was I again being grumpy? How did you actually find it?
I don't think you're wrong. I was a bit let down by this as well, especially because I actually really rate Alexandra Aja as a director. I don't know if you saw it, but Oxygen on Netflix was terrific. It's
I
one of those.
That, yeah, Melanie Laurent.
Correct. So, yeah, like a single person in a sort of capsule. So almost like that Ryan Reynolds film Buried, where she's just led down in this chamber for the entire film. I just don't think he was the right choice for it, really. Like, it's just a bit too, yeah, a bit. It just crawls along, no pun intended, and it all just feels just a bit stretched out as well. Like, I think this, people often say this about horror films or films with a singular high concept, but it just would be a sort of great sort of Black Mirror or Twilight Zone-y type short film thing. But when it's stretched to like an hour and 40 minutes, like there's just not enough meat on the bone here. And once you just get your head around the basic concepts, like, is this real or is it not real? Like, it just takes way too long to then play its hand. I will say there is like a very big thing that happens about an hour in, which I was quite surprised by and didn't see coming. After that, in service of that, like, it then just kills the entire third act of the film. Like, the third act of the film really sort of has nowhere to go, really, which I found like a very odd choice. It sort of looks nice, like they've shot in the middle of the woods somewhere, and it's one of those sort of slightly haunted, spooky looking woods where nothing feels particularly like alive in this wood. Like, everything, you could imagine like a sort of evil force lurking within it. And then the cabin in the woods itself is just, I certainly wouldn't want to live there. Like, it just looks creepy as hell. Like, you could imagine that being haunted. But yeah, the only thing I could really recommend about it are the two performances of the young boys, who are really strong for their age. Like, Aja's done an exceptional job getting believable performances out of them, and they do have to go to some pretty intense places. So I can't fault them. I learned in reading about this that Mark Romanek was supposed to direct this previously, when it was known as Motherland initially. Mark Romanek, of course, hasn't made a film in like 14 years, I think, since Never Let Me Go.
Yeah. Perhaps that's why he didn't do it, because I keep wanting to call this film Never Let Me Go as well. So I've struggled.
I almost thought I'd said the wrong name then, when I was like, Never Let Go, Never Let Me Go. Have I got those confused? But yeah, that is a strange coincidence. But yeah, I could sort of imagine a filmmaker like him doing something interesting with it. But yeah, this just didn't have enough to it. Like, I think it could have just done with a little something extra to give it a real kick. Yeah, a bit of a shame, really, because I had high hopes going in.
But that was Never Let Go. So if you fancy that, that is in cinemas now. And next up, Big Red is back.
Something in these hills. Something haunted. Evil. It smells like death.
How do you know that?
Dark things called dark things.
I heard tales about him all my life. Most just called him the Crooked Man.
Right, so this is Hellboy, the Crooked Man, which is the latest sort of attempt at adapting the Dark Horse Comics character Hellboy for the big screen. Previously, for what feels like a long time ago now, we had the two great Guillermo del Toro Hellboy movies. And then in 2019, we had the less great Neil Marshall Hellboy movie, which sort of replaced Ron Perlman with David Harbour. I mean, it was just pretty bad all around, that film. I think that was fairly unanimous. And then what feels like, I mean, obviously that was 5 years ago now, but it doesn't feel like that long ago. And we're already back with another reboot of Hellboy. But this time, interesting, it's directed by Brian Taylor, who was kind of, you know, best known for being part of Neville Dean Taylor with Mark Neville Dean. And so he kind of directed Crank and Gamer and the second Ghost Rider. So he's done a few kind of fairly big scale films like that. And which almost surprised me, because one thing about it does feel very low budget. Another thing that's sort of interesting about this is it's co-written by Mike Mignola, who created the Hellboy character in the comics. And it's based on a comic run, The Crooked Man. And I haven't actually read that, but apparently it's quite an accurate adaptation of this limited series, including even just, you know, ripping some dialogue direct. So I think it's kind of, in that sense, it's the most true direct adaptation of a Hellboy comic yet. This time around, we've got someone who, I must admit, I hadn't heard of this actor before. Jack Casey is playing Hellboy. And obviously he's kind of buried under a load of makeup again, and he's doing a similar kind of voice and performance to what we've heard previously from the character. In this film, we're set in the 50s, which is again another difference, kind of setting it apart from the other movies, which were kind of set in the more present day. It starts with Hellboy and Bobby Joe Song, who is a BPRD agent. That's the Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense, if you haven't seen a Hellboy movie for a while. And they're kind of traveling across the US on a train, looking after this sort of dangerous cargo, which is a sort of haunted spider type creature. And that gets loose. And then Hellboy and Bobby are thrown from the train. And then they basically end up stumbling upon this family and a guy called Tom Ferrell, played by Jefferson White. This leads them basically into a story of witches haunting this family and a figure known as the Crooked Man, who is kind of basically haunting this guy, haunting this family. And Hellboy and Bobby decide to kind of help Tom sort of sort his life and family out and try and get rid of these witches and this demonic crooked man. And Bobby's going to kind of follow along and document it all, basically. So that's the kind of setup. In that sense, it's more stripped back than previous Hellboy films. In large part, it feels like that's a sort of a budgetary necessity. Yeah, it's a strange one for me, because if we sort of segue into review mode now, I came to this with low expectations, in part because the last film was so poor. And then this did feel, to put it bluntly, a bit low rent, in the sense that, you know, it's kind of cast an actor I haven't heard of in the lead role when we've previously had, you know, these better known actors playing Hellboy. And you can just kind of see from the off that the budget's on the lower side. For that reason, it kind of leans more on the horror side of things than, you know, a big kind of spectacular fantasy adventure, which you could have described the others as. And so it's trying to do something different. And then for those reasons, I came to it with low expectations, and it kind of moderately impressed me against those low expectations, in a way where the expectations were so low that I kind of thought, right, well, fair enough, you've tried to do something a bit different here. It was, you know, solidly enough put together. There was some, decent enough makeup effects. I thought, most of the cast were fairly decent again, considering there was no, real names in there. Yeah, just had some half decent moments. But that's very much caveated with low expectations. And because you could tell the budget was so low, I was almost kind of strangely felt myself like rooting for it and thinking, oh, you can see they're being a bit economical here, and they're, trying to cover up this and that, and, make this go a bit further. And, some of the performances were obviously kind of, giving it their all clearly to sort of, paper over some of the cracks. So in that sense, I sort of felt weird feelings of like warmth, and I was kind of willing it on in that sense. But at the same time, I can't say I was ever particularly sort of thrilled or wowed by it at any point. But how did you find it, Jordan?
Yeah, I felt pretty much the same as you did, to be perfectly honest. When it first starts, my heart sort of sank, and I thought, oh no, because it did really feel like it was a fan film initially. Like for the first 10 minutes, I was thinking this was something you could see on YouTube. But actually, as it went along, like it did find its feet, or I got used to just the way it looked a little bit more. And I thought there were like a few creative things to it. The fact it is just more of a sort of folk horror superhero film, or comic book film, does give it a sort of unique flavor and a unique quality. Like I don't think I've seen anything quite like this in that comic book space. It's all set in the Appalachian wilderness. So you again, as with Never Let Go, we're sort of wandering around the woods for the most part in sort of rural communities where witchy goings on are happening. That's quite unique and different. It's certainly not something you tend to get for the entire duration of a film. And just seeing Hellboy, Big Red, stood in this environment does feel like quite unique and fun. And for the most part, it's a decent makeup job. I wouldn't say it's at the standard of, certainly not Guillermo's Hellboy. Ron Perlman just seemed to have the perfect face to play that character, whereas Jack Casey's face just feels a bit too modern. As people like to say, I just feel like Jack Casey's the kind of face who's seen an iPhone, whereas Ron Perlman feels like he's been drenched up from hell, where they do spend their money, they spend it well enough. Where the film really falls short is when it has to use CGI to accomplish certain things which couldn't be done practically. They make the sort of semi inexplicable decision to start the film on a train, which then careens off the tracks, and there was just no way they were going to be able to do that at the budget level they're working at. Like it just looks very cheap and fake, which is a shame because the practical work here is actually pretty decent for the most part. I thought Jack Casey was absolutely fine as Hellboy. Again, he doesn't live up to Ron Perlman's Hellboy, but I didn't think he sort of disgraced himself either. I sort of perfectly happily watch him in another film. Bobby Jo Song is an interesting enough side character. She has a bit of a backstory of her own involving her German heritage, which feels a little bit inconsequential to everything that's going on in the film, but I think is sort of setting things up for future films, should they ever be made. But yeah, what did work for me was the horror elements. There is some pretty creepy stuff in here, some pretty unsettling things. It's fairly ruthless as well. Like there are characters that suffer quite ignominious and horrible fates in a way that I don't recall from previous Hellboy films. As I found with the David Harbour Hellboy, I just find myself wishing that they just saved this money and spent it on a third Guillermo film, Like that's what everyone wants, right? Just let
That's
him finish that trilogy. Like I don't know why we keep having to go back to the well with this character, reinventing him when the win is right there. Just do that and close the loop on this, and then maybe we can move on, because any film that gets made is just going to be compared to what will never be, which is the greatest shame of it all. But they're on sort of the right track with it, certainly an improvement after the Neil Marshall film. But again, it just isn't everything it could be, which is a shame.
It's like I say, it's a strange one for me where you definitely have to manage your expectations, but it does help that it is doing something a little bit different at least, and it's not trying to be quite the same sort of fantasy adventure. But you have to kind of, like manage your expectations. You have to kind of go knowing it's going to be leaning into that sort of slightly folky horror element, and you also have to just accept it's not Ron Perlman. But yes, otherwise, in my mind, I still ultimately err on this. I think I'd ultimately err on the side of just about worth checking out. But if you do fancy checking that out, that is Hellboy: The Crooked Man, which is in cinemas now. And now for the final film this week, it's a mind-altering coming of ager.
No, not the whole bag.
May you experience a new level of consciousness tonight.
Oh my God, are you guys tripping?
I don't feel anything.
That's because we don't tolerate drugs well.
Hey, freak. Who are you?
Elliot.
Dude, I'm you.
You're me.
What's up?
I don't have a gap in my teeth.
Yeah, where are your retainer? Left boob, one cup smaller than the right.
I'm actually kind of hot for being middle-aged.
I'm 39 years old. That's not middle-aged.
No, that is middle-aged.
No, it's not. I am a very young adult.
Okay, so this is My Old Ass. That's the film title. I'm not just being rude there. Jordan, do you want to set this one up for us?
There are plenty of ass jokes in this film, as you've probably guessed. So yeah, this is the new film from writer-director Megan Park, who was previously an actor and has now moved behind the camera. It stars Maisie Stellar as Elliot. She is a 19-year-old who's about to leave home. She lives in Muskoka, which is a sort of lake town in Ontario, Canada. She's about to go to university in Toronto, and it's her sort of last week at home. And she goes out onto a small island near where she lives with a couple of friends, and they decide to get high and take some mushrooms. Elliot thinks that she isn't affected by these mushrooms, but then all of a sudden, sitting next to her is Aubrey Plaza, who is also playing Elliot, but 39-year-old Elliot, aka herself from the future. And what follows is a sort of conversation, a sort of frank and funny conversation about growing old, about what life can be as you get older, the steps you take. Young Elliot obviously asks old Elliot who the apple of the future is going to be, that so nice. She can invest and become incredibly rich. But the main takeaway from this initial conversation that the two characters have is that young Elliot must avoid a person called Chad, who she has not met yet and doesn't have a clue who this is, which old Elliot tells her about, but doesn't tell her why she has to avoid this Chad. And then, wouldn't you know it, the next day, Elliot is skinny dipping in a local body of water, and all of a sudden there pops up Chad, who's played by Percy Hines White. And he's initially very friendly, but we as an audience are obviously very skeptical and want Elliot to stay away. But as the film goes on, Elliot and Chad inevitably get closer together, and young Elliot takes the advice of her older self and tries to make the most of her time at home with her family before she heads off to university. And I don't want to say too much more than that, but that is the sort of setup of the film in a nutshell.
Yeah, I'm going to get straight in and say I absolutely loved this film. And I felt like I was going to, because we had like a news piece in the magazine a little while back by Jamie Graham. And I thought, oh, that sounds up my street. Because although they're not really, you know, they're not really similar at all in most ways, but a bit like with All of Us Strangers, I just love that idea of being able to meet people at different times in their lives. Obviously, this is a bit of a twist in the sense that it's, you know, someone meeting themselves at a different time in their life. But just that kind of thing, I've just always loved that idea. It kind of handles it in a very low-key way. And again, this is the only comparison I'll make between this film I'm going to mention as well. But as with The Substance last week, I watched these two films very close together. And one thing which I liked about both of them is they have these high concepts, but they just keep them really simple, basically. They just don't try and over-explain it. They don't just make it complicated. They don't try and give a sort of pseudo-scientific explanation for it. It's just presented, and then you just get on with it. And then for me, when it's done well within a good film, it's just so much better that way. And I think anytime any element like this is tried to be overly explained, it just makes you kind of question it even more, whereas it's just given to you, get on with it, accept it, deal with it, enjoy the film. I really fell in love with the characters, particularly Maisie Stellar as Elliot, just one of those people I just instantly kind of warmed to and just liked on screen and just enjoyed spending time with. Then I found Percy Hines White as Chad just very charming as well. And again, he kind of turns up, and there's, you know, there is this sort of tension because, you know, she's been warned against him. So there's that playing into it. And then I just liked Elliot's family, thought they were funny. I also love stories where it's on the cusp of, like, where someone's on the cusp of leaving for college, someone's on the cusp of sort of big life change, a rite of passage sort of moment. I love the kind of concept of the fact that we inevitably take things for granted when we have them, you know, and the idea of getting a chance to not take something for granted, I suppose, getting a sort of a glimpse outside of yourself and appreciating what you've got in a moment, resonated a lot for me as well. And and I suppose as well, again, just before I invite your opinion, I'll just say it's a strange one that I would say, despite me absolutely gushing, I still think you've almost got to go in with slightly managed expectations, because it's a low-key sort of film, you know, so in some ways it still is just best approached, you know, with that in mind. the high concept is a sort of small element of it. It doesn't get like overly, there's not overly convoluted, time loops or anything like that. Aubrey Plaza's not even really in it that much as well. That's another thing I think, I mean, understandably, they've kind of sold it on her quite a lot, but she's a kind of relatively small aspect of the film. So yeah, so in that sense, it's a small film. It's like light, but for me personally, yeah, it really, really kind of struck for me. But did you like, he's just gonna come in now and say, yeah, he did
No, I hated it. No, yeah,
it.
I loved it. Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah, I agree with pretty much every word you said there. The thing I'd add is that it has that, I don't know if this is the best comparison point, but obviously a film that also starred Aubrey Plaza, but it has that sort of safety not guaranteed quality where it is sort of, I guess, technically a sci-fi film, or certainly has an element of magical realism in the fact that the Elliots are able to speak to each other. But as you say, it just doesn't lean too heavily on that. The film sort of questions what they can do with each other. How much can younger Elliot learn from older Elliot? But older Elliot's just sort of reluctant to tell her too much, and because she doesn't know what the result is going to be if she does. And you just sort of buy it. You're just like, yeah, fair enough. You don't need to tell her anything. Like, you want her to experience life as it comes. And yeah, I can buy that. And then the bulk of the film is just a sort of coming of age romance, basically. The relationship between Elliot and Chad is just incredibly charming and sweet and funny, and they're just a really endearing on-screen couple. As you say, Maisie Stella, like a real sort of star-making performance from her, reminded me a little bit of Elsie Fisher from Eighth Grade, even though she's an older actress. Just immediately found her very endearing and loved watching her on screen. Even though it is a very sort of small film in some ways, it does have like a huge emotional kick to it. Some very like profound things to say about, yeah, growing up, leaving home, why you should appreciate the moment while you're living it. And then it really delivers on the whole Chad side of it, I would say, what you're sort of expecting to result from who Chad is. He isn't entirely the person you expect. And I thought what it did with that was very clever and very, very moving. So yeah, by the end of this, I was really like, oh, trying to hold it together,
Yeah, no, I was
but yeah,
similar,
just very sweet, very warmly made. And I thought Muskoka was just a very interesting location for a film like this as
yeah.
well, because they're just out on like boats and things like that, and it's just a natural part of life. Elliot's family run a farm, a sort of cranberry farm, and yeah, it's just interesting texture to this world that a story like this just could have been set in a boring city, but it does give it a sort of unique bit of personality, a unique identity. So yeah, it felt just very well thought through, and yeah, for the most part, just very entertaining, very sweet, very moving, and yeah, well worth watching, I'd say.
Yeah, it's definitely 100% a film I'll kind of revisit again over time, and I'd be shocked if this doesn't end up in my like top 10 of the year come the end of the
Whoa,
year. I'd be very
big words.
it'd be some kind of amazing year if this doesn't end up in my top 10 by the time we reach the end of the year. Again, as I've said, it played right into just the things I like, so was very much a film for me in that sense, but I'd kind of comfortably recommend this to a lot of people, really. I think it's got a pretty broad appeal.
Hell of a week for old Aubrey Plaza as well. My old ass Megalopolis and Agatha all along. She's busy, busy and
Well,
booked, as they
she
say.
is. She is. And she's my exact birthday twin as well, but she's only slightly more successful than me, I'd say, but what we've done in our sort of 40,
Debatable.
what we've done
Yeah.
in our 40 years so far. But I think that's another reason why it sort of just strangely resonated with me, knowing that I was the exact same age as this future self as well in this film. But there you go.
It really does make you think, though, like, what would I say to myself at
Oh,
19
yeah.
years old?
That's again just another thing I just love in films is when you come out thinking about stuff like that, and if you watch it with someone else, you just come out thinking, yeah, exactly, like what would you say to those people? What would you do if you could, speak to your younger self? What would you do if you were your younger self and you had more time to spend with your family or whatever? Just like, I love it when films inspire those kind of conversations afterwards as well. But if you fancy getting in on that is My Old Ass, which is in cinemas now. I mean, you have to obviously go up and ask for a ticket for it, which is slightly awkward, but definitely worth the embarrassment, I would say. But as we approach the end of the podcast now, Jordan, what is your film of the week this week?
Pretty much neck and neck between the Outrun and My Old Ass for me, but as I assume you're going to pick My Old Ass, I'll go for the Outrun.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm definitely going for My Old Ass, but I highly rated The Outrun as well, so that would have been sort of second for me. But yes, so just as we sort of wrap up, a reminder that our Penguin issue is still on sale now, if you're kind of following along with that new DC show as it's airing right now. And we've also just finished an extra special issue, which will be on sale on the 10th of October. So look out for that. We also need to say that this podcast is going on hiatus. So this is the last episode of Inside Toy Film you'll hear for the time being. Thanks so much for listening so far. And if you want to drop us a line about anything, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. Before we go, just time for a quick question. Which two bona fide movie stars would you like to see team up for a new project?
I mean, so many, but I decided to go for the biggest of the big and
Okay.
say Tom Cruise,
Yes.
numero uno, and Leo. Imagine
Nice.
those two on screen together.
Whoa.
I mean, it's part of this question, like what type of film we'd want to see them in, or,
I mean, I guess so, yeah.
obviously I'd love to see Leo in a Mission Impossible film, but I'd be more excited by the idea of, because of course Leonardo DiCaprio is working with Paul Thomas Anderson right now. Tom Cruise gave one of his best ever performances in a Paul Thomas Anderson film, Magnolia, of course. So I'd love to see them both double-head Paul Thomas Anderson film. Can you imagine?
And isn't Tom Cruise shooting a film with Alejandro G. Iñárritu
Yeah.
right now as well, who obviously
That's
very
right, yeah.
famously worked with Leo as well? So maybe they could work with him as well. That would be good. That's a good shout. I sort of slightly cheated on my thought in a way that I thought I'm going to go for two people who've been together already, and I think people who are kind of bona fide movie stars as well, which is Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. That I would like to see them either make another Nice Guys, because come on, we all just want that.
It's what we all need.
That's obviously the real reason I want them to be together again. But if not, I just think they had such great chemistry in that film that I would obviously just watch anything that they did together, and I'd just be very intrigued to see how they would bounce off each other as slightly different characters in a slightly different world. So yeah, that was my pick.
That you probably need Shane Black on scripting duties with whichever they're going to do. They just he just had the perfect voice for those two, didn't he? But
He did.
yeah, a great choice.
That's all from us for now. So thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye. One